Hello, everybody. I'm Lou Dobbs. Ukraine and Russia are apparently ready to resume their negotiations for a ceasefire in the war that has been underway for 33 days now. President Volodymyr Zelensky trying to create some impetus for the truce talks, saying he's now ready to discuss neutrality, as he put it, for Ukraine. And as Russian troop movements indicate, Vladimir Putin is organizing his forces for what possibly could be a partitioning of Ukraine into two separate states, west and east. The easternmost of the states would likely include the now Russia-recognized Republic of Donetsk and Republic of Luhansk. That's partly my speculation and presumes that Putin is ready to hold substantive talks. But it's also based on a Zelensky statement that he would compromise on the, quote, status of the Donbas region. Depending on the details, such a compromise and result would meet Putin's demand for a further buffer with NATO nations on Russia's western border and assure the security as well of the Donbas region, including the two republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. I'm also skeptical of whether Zelensky's political supporters will allow him to agree to a partitioning of Ukraine and whether Putin will agree to anything less. And the war goes on, and so does the bombardment of western Ukraine, including Kiev, a brutal, deadly Russian offensive now underway. And we've learned in the past 24 hours that the peace talks between Russia and Ukraine got off to an unexpected and potentially lethal start. The Wall Street Journal reporting two Ukrainian representatives to those talks and Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich suffered symptoms that resulted from what was possibly a poison attack. Some of their symptoms, including irritated eyes, pain, and peeling flesh on their faces and hands, indicated poison. The condition of the three victims has improved, and we're told they're no longer in danger. President Biden is still trying to explain to the world, and in particular to President Putin, that in no way did he intend to say he wanted Putin removed from his office, although he did say that Putin, quote, cannot remain in power, end quote. That apparently is now inoperative in the Biden White House. And Biden's budget plan for the next fiscal year calls for almost $6 trillion more in spending. The Biden budget is busted already, in my view. There's little chance the public won't be outraged by more out-of-control Democrat spending. Last month, the federal budget deficit was over $200 billion, and the national debt, well over $30 trillion now. Our national debt is 125% of our total gross domestic product. That's not good. Not good economics, not good politics, and not good for the country. As for the loyal opposition, the Republicans' House members held their annual retreat to strategize ahead of the fall midterms, which they expect to put them back in power. To that end, the GOPers emphasized unity. Joining us now, one of the Republican Party's most respected House members, co-founder of the Freedom Caucus and seven-term Congressman Jim Jordan, representing Ohio's 4th District. Congressman Jim Jordan, it's always great to have you here on the Great America Show. Let's start with the meeting, the retreat, the summit, if you will, of your conference over the past weekend. Your basic judgment about how positive it was?
Oh, no, very positive. The Republicans are positive. We're obviously concerned about the country. I mean, jeepers, this administration, you know, we've talked before, Lou, they haven't done a darn thing right. I mean, you look at the border. We went from secure border to chaos. You look at we went from stable prices to 40-year high inflation. We went from safe streets to record crime. And of course, we went from energy independence to the situation we find ourselves in today. And we haven't even got into foreign policy. We haven't even got into what they've done to our basic liberties. So, yeah, that's a mess. But the conference with Republicans in the House, very optimistic. You know, I always say that you never want to be overconfident in any type of competition, but I think we're confident that if we go out and campaign hard, talk about what we'll do for America, run on a populist message rooted in conservative principle like President Trump did, that we got a great chance of taking this thing back and being in control next year. So yeah, it was very positive.
I'm hearing a lot of people talk, and by that I mean elected officials like yourself, who are talking about the Republicans are going to wipe out the Democrats come November. Then I hear an edge of caution from them, like, well, you don't want to take anything for mm-hmm. granted. But the truth is, it looks like this could be a wave election, so-called, and that you could make immense, perhaps even historic gains in both the House and lesser so, but significant gains in the Senate.
Well, I hope that's the case. I think there's a real chance of that. There's, there was a piece a few weeks back in the Journal that talked about a potential realignment. I would actually argue just a continuation of what President Trump started, running as an America First populist agenda. As I said before, populist agenda rooted in conservative principles. So I think there's that chance, because you think about it, Lou, in my mind, the Democrat Party has now become the party of the super mega wealthy who live on the coast and people who don't work. And Republicans are the party of everybody else. We're the party of families, working people, flyover country. And you know, the Democrats have taken this attitude that, oh, they're so much smarter and better. Now, how about when Anderson Cooper said, you know, Trump voters stay at the Marriott and eat at Olive Garden? And I'm like, that's the disdain and the arrogance they have for us regular middle class folks. And I was telling one group the other day, I said, you know, eating at Olive Garden and stay at the Marriott, that's out where I'm from in Western Ohio, that's a pretty good weekend. So I do think that mindset is out there.
It sounds pretty fancy to me, too, to tell you the truth.
Exactly.
Anderson Cooper, was he a Rockefeller, a Vanderbilt? I can't remember which part of that deal.
I think it was the latter, and I guess he stays at just the super five-star fancy place, the Ritz, all the time, and us regular folks stay at the Holiday Inn and the Marriott.
You bet. As a matter of fact, my wife and I are thrilled just to stay on the farm. I want to go to that very important issue, and that is your leadership. You just brought up Donald Trump, in my opinion, the greatest president in modern history. He wasn't at your retreat. Why not?
No, I don't know why the leadership decided not to do that. But I know President Trump had another one of his great rallies over the weekend, down in the great state of Georgia, important state in the upcoming election. But you're right. I think certainly the most effective president in our lifetimes, maybe ever. And, you know, you and I've talked a lot about this before, but doing what he said he would do and doing it when everyone was, all the Democrats were against him, all the mainstream press, a bunch of Republicans, everyone in the bureaucracy, which is maybe the most important concern. And in spite of all that, got so much done. That's the kind of leadership we need, and I hope we're going to have it again. I think he's going to run. I hope he does, and I hope he wins.
As do I. And him not being there, it makes me wonder about the commitment to leadership. And that is, here's a man who is all you said, and in fact, more. He had the Russians against him, the Chinese against him. He had all of the power centers in this country against him. I would think that your folks would want to hear from him. But be that as it may, I hope there's not a single Republican running for office who isn't an America First candidate, because that seems to me to be the essential truth of the matter. There won't be a Republican wave unless they are American First candidates winning.
I agree. President Trump, I think, has fundamentally changed the party, fundamentally changed the country in such a positive way. And the contrast, I was talking with a person who worked in the Trump administration last week, and he said, think about this, President Trump, when you speak in relatively speaking, he turned over to President Biden a stable and relatively calm world with the Abraham Accords, where we stood in the world, we were respected. He turned it over to Joe Biden, and Joe Biden has screwed up everything. I mean, literally everything. You look at what happened last summer. The picture, I think, that will be in people's minds as they think about the Biden administration is that picture in Afghanistan, where you had people trying to jump on the wheels of that plane as it took off and left left Afghanistan. That's the metaphor for just how bad the Biden administration has been. Mm-hmm. And again, what a contrast between way President Trump led and his team led versus the folks running the country now.
You know, Congressman, I have to say, I'm more than a little worried about whether or not mm-hmm. the Republican Party will be the party of Trump, an America First party, or the rhinos, who, by the way, to me, really are, frankly, they are an alien organism in the party. And I really mean that they're just destroying the party and destroying representation for the American people, because they are basically left wingers. They're Democrats. You know, Romney is the ultimate example of a rhino, and he is a Democrat and a confused one at that. But most Democrats are confused, so that's just consistent. What is your view of rhinos and how you can get rid of them, and whether or not you think that the American people will still vote Republican for rhinos?
Yeah, I trust the voters. I trust the American people. I think that they've figured it out like they always do. They're going to elect the right kind of Republicans. They're going to come here and fight for them, their family, do what they said they would do, stand up for America First principles. You saw this begin to play out last fall in Virginia, where we learned that the Department of Education had communicated with the School Board Association prior to them sending the letter. And then we find out the Department of Justice does the memorandum that treats parents as domestic terrorists. And that issue, moms and dads standing up and pushing back on what was happening in their schools, is what put Glenn Youngkin in the governor's office in a blue state. So the country gets it. They're not going to stand for the Republicans who aren't committed to the principles that make our country a special place. And again, you saw that last fall in Virginia. A few weeks after that, you saw – I think this is amazing too, Lou. You saw 12 brave jurors in Kenosha, Wisconsin, with the mob outside the courthouse. The mob outside say, we're still going to do what's consistent with the facts, the truth, and due process, and reach the right decision here. And they did. So the country is figuring it out, and they have had it with – the crazy left and Republicans who aren't acting like Republicans.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. When you talk about America's figured it out, I believe voters have figured it out. The American public has figured it out. And I am yet to be convinced that the Republicans have figured it out.
The politicians in D.C.
I'm really very serious about it. I think there's huge skepticism about Kevin McCarthy, Mitch McConnell. I think it rises to more than skepticism. There's great doubt about their leadership, because really neither of them has done a damn thing. And
let me just say this regarding Leader McCarthy. I think he's done such a good job of keeping our team together compared to the leadership of our lack of leadership, I guess you could say, of compared to, you know, the previous leaders of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. You know, I always go back to the first impeachment. And remember, the conventional wisdom was that every single Democrat was going to vote to impeach President Trump, and a bunch of Republicans were going to join him. But we went through that process, and under the leadership of Kevin McCarthy and our team here in the House. And what happened in the end, Lou, was every Republican voted against impeaching President Trump. Democrats joined us, and one Democrat switched parties. So that is so different. I guarantee that would – I don't think that would have happened under the previous leader. So, you know, we got to stay focused on, as you say – standing up for the America First agenda of President Trump, doing what we said we did, like President Trump did. And if the voters put us in control, if we stay focused on that, we're gonna help frame things up for 2024 when I hope President Trump runs again.
Well, you and me both, and tens of millions of Americans as well. I hear you. You're supporting Kevin McCarthy. And do you know something? I just simply can't. But I'll tell you this much. I can get a lot closer if Jim Jordan is for him, and you tell me that Kevin McCarthy is for Jim Jordan and the Trump agenda, then I can get a long ways toward Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah. You know why? We need that to happen, because that's what's good for the country. That would help the country if we could stay focused as a team doing the America First agenda and framing up the 2024 race. So if let's say the people put us back in control, Lou, we're going to pass some good legislation. Joe Biden's going to veto it, or it's not going to get through the Senate. But we're going to help frame up the 2024 race when President Trump's going to run against Biden or Harris, whoever the Democrats decide to put up. I think that's going to help bring the country together, help turn out even more voters for President Trump than he got in the last race and put him in the White House. That's what we need to do in order to help change things and move things back in the right direction for our country.
That's good to hear. My problem is the 8 months we've got here before we get to a little over 7 months. I haven't seen any action taken by the RNC or the Republican Party nationally to secure the election, to roll back mail-in ballots, to stop the national emergency, to go after this president, because it's for the sake of the country. I mean, we just watched a president commit five mistakes and misstatements on this trip to Europe.
Yeah.
He has perhaps still escalated the war, the Russian war against Ukraine, with his mouth. His mind is not there. He is impaired. Why in the world aren't the Republicans as a body demanding this man do as Donald Trump did when the Democrats asked him to take a cognitive test? He's been asked twice, rejected it twice. Why not? Why isn't the Republican Party demanding it?
Well, Ronny Jackson, a colleague of
Ronny Jackson
Ronny is. Oh, he's got the bill. He's got the bill out there to do. No, I heard former Speaker Gingrich on an interview this past week, and he said, you know, like he said basically the same thing, and he said, but also, you know, think about it.
He said what
look
I said.
Look at the vice president. Yeah, well, he said something to the same effect. He said, you know, look, this is everyone sees what we see, but they also see the vice president. When she went to Poland a week or so ago, and the thing she said, I mean, like, I think Speaker Gingrich said they should never let her leave the country again. I think it was something to that effect. And I'm like, wow, that's an amazing statement from former Speaker Gingrich, who's as you know, is a sharp guy. So, the country sees it, the world sees it, and what a contrast between the leadership and the strength and the toughness, frankly, that was projected from the Oval Office under President Trump. And over the Secretary of State's office under Mike Pompeo. What a contrast we see between that and what we now have with Biden, Harris, and Blinken. You couldn't have a sharper contrast. The people see that, the country does, and I think again that's what's gonna weigh on their decision, and why I think we have a good chance of being in the majority.
So what you're saying is, and what Newt said was then, we're not going to do anything until there's election. And meanwhile, we'll just hold our breath, sit on our hands and pray like hell.
Well, I don't think we could get anything, obviously through either the House or Senate and a bill. We can continue to call for it, which I think that, you know, the common sense folks of this great country understand it.
And I'm not asking for an impeachment. I'm not asking for the 25th Amendment. I am asking for a cognitive test so the American people are either assured that he is competent, or we understand what everyone as adults are dealing with. This is not a nation of children. Yeah. We're big time all American citizens, and we need to know what the hell is going on.
No, I think that makes so much sense. And again, it's why I think our good friend and colleague, Congressman Jackson, has actually introduced legislation and now talking about this issue as well as should.
All right. On that positive note and uplifting note, Congressman, I know that you're pressed for time as always, and I appreciate you being with us. Thanks so much.
Always enjoy it. Yeah. Keep up the great work, Lou. Thanks so much. Take care, brother.
You too, Congressman. Thank you. Congressman Jim Jordan, great American. And now we turn to Russia's senior partner in the China-Russia Strategic Alliance. China President Xi Jinping is fully backing Putin and Russia. And without that backing, Russia would be under even greater economic pressure. With China's backing, Putin can continue his war on Ukraine, which has proved to be far more difficult than I'm sure he ever imagined. Interestingly, Xi is encountering challenges of his own at home, the COVID virus stubbornly reappearing at a major outbreak in another major city. Xi forced to lock down one of China's largest and most important cities, Shanghai. 25 million people live and work there, a major commercial and financial center. As Xi is now more than 2 years after the deadly virus was unleashed on an unsuspecting world, again contending with a massive outbreak of the virus, while Vladimir Putin is struggling with the war he started 33 days ago. Joining us now is Asian expert, attorney, author, most recently of the great U.S.-China tech war, Gordon Chang. Gordon is also columnist for Newsweek and regular co-host and guest on the John Batchelor Show. And Gordon, first of all, it's great to have you back on the show here. China seems to be wanting to play a very important central part in the Ukraine crisis. What is the motivation there?
I believe that Beijing, which was really surprised by the turn of events in Ukraine, by the heroic resistance of the Ukrainian people, now is trying to distance itself from Russia. But we shouldn't be fooled, Lou, because China is still backing Russia where it counts. It's still buying wheat, oil, gas, coal. It is providing Russia a refuge in its SIPs, which is its SWIFT alternative. It is just basically giving Vladimir Putin the money to continue this war against Ukraine. So although we hear statements from Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, from Wang Yi, the foreign minister, and from others about how, you know, all of this is terrible, we shouldn't believe any of it. That's just disinformation.
Disinformation. And again, China, Xi himself calling for maximum restraint, as he put it, in Ukraine. And I didn't have the feeling he was speaking directly to Vladimir Putin. Did you?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think he was referring to Western countries, to the United States, to France and Germany in particular, about not providing lethal aid to Ukraine. Matter of fact, not even providing humanitarian aid to the Ukrainian people. You know, it's difficult sometimes to decipher what Beijing is saying, but you have to watch what they're doing. And the important thing here is that the announcement of the $117.5 billion in new oil and gas deals on February 4th, a week after that, there was the announcement of the sale of 100 million metric tons of Russian coal to China. China then lifted restrictions on the importation of Russian wheat. This couldn't be any clearer. Beijing is financing Russia's military operations in Eastern Europe.
They're financing those operations, and they are, based on everything that we have seen in the reporting of the deal they have, they are full-on strategic partners, these two communist parties and powers, that is China and Russia, are they not?
You're absolutely right about that. I mean, they've got decades of cooperation where they coordinate their foreign policies, where their militaries drill together. But this was symbolized in the 5,000-word joint statement that China and Russia issued on February 4th, which was just after the meeting between Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, a meeting that lasted more than 2.5 hours. And I believe it was at that meeting that the Chinese greenlighted the invasion of Ukraine, because it was only 4 days after the Olympics that Russian armor crossed the Ukrainian border.
And that Russian armor now is, for the most part, it seems, deployed across Ukraine in various cities, but also part of what is a stalled offensive that one would have expected to have moved much quicker, to be even more deadly than it's been, actually, and far more successful. What is going on with the Russian military? Your thoughts.
The Russian military certainly has surprised even Western intelligence agencies in its failure to move effectively against a lightly armed resistance. There are a lot of reasons for that, including basically faulty Chinese parts for their tanks. But the thing here, Lou, to look at, step back at a moment, China has called for mediation to end the fighting. And it's no coincidence that China only called for mediation after it was clear that the Russian advance had stalled. What they're trying to do is to give Putin a way to consolidate his gains. Because if there is no mediation, I believe that Ukraine will actually push Russia out of their country. And that's the last thing that China wants to see. It needs to have Putin to be successful, because this is a partnership between Moscow and Beijing. And if one of the partners fails, it calls into question the effectiveness of the other partner. Of course, in this case, China.
And China, it may be that she has now made a mistake of huge proportions in partnering with Vladimir Putin. And Russia is now the one who looks like, certainly in the relationship vis-a-vis China, to be seriously the junior partner.
Yes, and Russia is going to become even more junior if events fold out, unfold as we think. You know, part of it is because as the West has disconnected Russia from the dollar accounts, from the SWIFT system, basically, Russia is moving into the renminbi system of China, moving into CIPS, which is the cross-border interbank payment system, which is China's SWIFT alternative. There's more and more commodity deals that are being conducted in renminbi, the Chinese currency. So we're seeing Beijing basically make Russia an economic colony. And if all of this weren't clear enough, there are now reported talks for China to take big states in Gazprom and Rusal, the energy and the aluminum companies. So this is really stunning to watch Russia become a part of a Chinese economic sphere.
To become a part of it, and again, with every prospect of becoming the senior partner as well as participant, because their currency, their hard reserves, China is a behemoth by comparison to Russia in every way, in purchasing parity, in terms of assets, in terms of size of economy across the board, whether nominal or purchasing power. This is a peculiar partnership in that respect. What do you think the real purpose of that partnership is?
I believe that China has used Russia all along as essentially the proxy. Russia, under Putin, has very much been willing to take on the West in ways that are very clear, unmistakable. And that's allowed China to advance its goals pretty much under the radar. There was something similar. When you go back to 9/11, just before that, the administration of George W. Bush was thinking of moving against China. But after 9/11, China became an ally in the effort to end Osama bin Laden's life. Something similar is occurring here, because you're hearing people in the American policy establishment start to talk about, well, we need China's help to constrain Russia. So there's this same sort of replaying of themes. It didn't work with regard to Al-Qaeda. It certainly didn't work with regard to North Korea, where George W. wanted to have the Chinese disarm their best friends, the North Koreans. And it's not going to work now, Lou. I mean, the Chinese will continue to do this because they get away with it. And they get away with it because of the naivete of American policymakers. This is just sort of like Groundhog Day.
It is Groundhog Day in lots of ways. It is in the repetition of it all. It's, history that doesn't repeat often rhymes. But in this instance, Xi Jinping looks to be playing Putin, if you will, for a dupe. If one thinks about, it was 2 years ago that Xi Jinping unleashed a deadly virus on the world when he could have given warning, when he could have stopped it and chose not to. And now in this country, almost a million dead without any response. And now, 2 years after the Wuhan virus, we now are watching Putin destabilizing what at least is Eastern Europe. And certainly the Ukrainian crisis has the potential to involve all of Europe and perhaps more. It looks all to be a piece of a part, doesn't it?
It certainly does. As Putin moves against Ukraine and tries to reconstitute the Soviet Empire, as he tries to reconstitute the Russian Empire, which is even broader than that, China is going to, I think, be even more provocative against, of course, Taiwan, but also India, where China is building up its forces, opposing India in Ladakh, high in the Himalayas. But it could also be against Japan, the Philippines, Bhutan, Nepal, all across China's southern and eastern peripheries. It's moving against neighbors. And so therefore, we could see conflict on both ends of the Eurasian landmass. These two countries have, Russia and China have proxies, North Korea, Iran, Pakistan, even Algeria, where there could be problems right in the near future.
And the South China Sea, of course. What is, in your judgment, Xi's plan and purpose here? Because he is without question ambitious, he's expansionary in his policies, all of them, in every direction, every direction that's available to him in China. Where does this lead? Because Ukraine is not going well, and his junior partner is in appears to be in significant trouble.
Well, a couple things. With regard to your first question about Xi Jinping's plans, he's made it very clear in his pronouncements over the course of three decades that he believes that he is the world's only legitimate ruler. He's pushing the notion of Tianxia, or all under heaven. This is the idea that Chinese rulers had the mandate of heaven over Tianxia, and that not only did they have the right to rule all under heaven, but that heaven compelled them to do so. And this is, you know, there have been a number of figures in history who believe that they should rule the world, but Xi Jinping is the first to believe he should rule planet Earth plus the near parts of the solar system, because we've heard these Chinese officials talk about the moon and Mars as sovereign Chinese territory. You know, with regard to where things are going with Ukraine, which is your second question, God only knows. But the problem here is that Vladimir Putin knows that if he fails, he's probably going to lose power and maybe lose his life, which means that he could use his weapons of mass destruction in Ukraine, his chemical weapons or nuclear weapons. He's threatened to do so. We've got to be concerned that the worst scenarios will actually play out.
Let me ask you, you talk about the moon, the stars. Sometimes more proximate is more expedient. And right next door to Russia is this little country called China. Why not, if you're Xi Jinping, play Putin for a dupe and a fool, let him hemorrhage, and then move against him and establish an empire that has never, you know, that hasn't been brought together for 5,000 years, if we're going to start reconstituting empires.
Yeah, this is not a theoretical concern, because Chinese policymakers, plus the Chinese academic community, always talk about how the Russian Far East, which includes Vladivostok, was lost to the czars. Now, this is a false narrative, but this is what the Chinese believe, that those treaties in the 1860s, which ceded Qing Dynasty land to the Tsars, really were unequal, and therefore China should get them back, which means that a good portion of the Russian Far East, in the views of Beijing, should be China's. Now, that's bad history, and we probably don't have time enough to go into why it's bad history, but the point is not whether it's good or bad history, but it's the point that this is what Chinese leaders say and what they believe. And that means Vladimir Putin is at risk of losing a good portion of his country to China.
And we hear no one speak of that. We hear no one concerned about that, I guess, because it would be sort of intramural, if you will, amongst communist and former communist nations. I don't know how you would describe properly either country, really. China is certainly communist, but both tyrannies, both leaders despots. So give us your sense of where Ukraine leads us, and what is China's real motivation is here, and how significant is it, as opposed to the world's focus on Vladimir Putin.
China wants Putin to succeed because that then roils the world. The longer term effects of Ukraine, regardless of who wins or who loses there, and I think the Ukrainian people will eventually win, although it may not be in the short term, but the long term effects will be deglobalization. In other words, countries are going to be trading with each other less. They're going to be certainly more focused at home. We're already starting to see this. The February trade numbers show shocking declines in trade around the world. And remember, the invasion only started February 24th. Right. So this will continue. This means
still record trade deficits for the United States.
Still record trade deficits for the United States, which another issue. But we have these global supply chains which stretch halfway around the world, many of them starting in China. These are not viable in the new environment post-Ukraine. And that means, Lou, that the United States and other countries are going to start to locate manufacturing closer to home, if not within their borders. This is something that we need to do. We cannot continue to enrich an enemy, China, with our trade and with our investment. We have these global supply lockups in the twin ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. That's completely unnecessary. We should be making critical goods and most of our goods inside the United States. I think that will be one of the long-term effects of Ukraine, this deglobalization.
Deglobalization and the United States now dependent, however, on globalization for its some of its most strategic needs, including, first of all, let's talk about pharmaceuticals. 95% of our pharmaceuticals and pharmaceutical ingredients come from China and to a degree, India. What are we
yes.
to do?
And Rosemary Gibson wrote that fabulous book, China RX, which details our vulnerabilities to Chinese manufacturing of pharmaceuticals and active pharmaceutical ingredients. Americans have died because of polluted heparin, for instance, made in China. So this is not a theoretical concern for us. And China actually has threatened to cut off the supply of pharmaceuticals to the US in order to obtain its unrelated geopolitical goals. So this is something which we've known about for a long time. President Trump tried to bring back some of this API manufacturing into the United States with his Eastman Kodak deal. This is more of what we have to do in the future. And of course, it's not just pharmaceuticals. We're talking semiconductors, personal protective equipment, rare earths, you name it. We need to bring it back here.
We need to, but in some cases, such as you mentioned rare earth, China happens to have the largest repositories of rare earths and manufacturing products utilizing rare earths, and that includes the most advanced electronics and computers, as semiconductors, you name it. It's a tremendous strategic advantage. And they will then also, as a result of our having that rapid departure from Afghanistan, will have access to all of those rare earths that are deposits in Afghanistan. The list goes on, and everywhere you look, people are focused now, of course, on Russia and Ukraine, and properly so. But the reality is China is on the move, are they not?
Well, they certainly are. And they are for a number of reasons, both because they feel they're strong and because they feel insecure. But whatever the reason is, it's a dangerous political system right now, especially because Xi Jinping, the ruler, I believe, for various internal reasons, has a low threshold of risk. It's like Vladimir Putin also has a low threshold. Now, Xi's reasons for the low threshold are different, but nonetheless, it makes both of them dangerous. So we have these two large tyrannies on the march at the same time.
Well, let's go back to the world's greatest democracy, the United States, led by something called Democrats, But in point of fact, these are two of the most incompetent, inept people I've ever seen in American government anywhere. And they sit atop the United States now. And I'm talking about the President Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris. And they have decided that this is a unique and wonderful, even welcome opportunity to talk about Americans buying more electric cars as they ban Russian oil. It is, tell me what in the world we're to do, given all that's happening geopolitically with a leadership like this.
We have an election this November. It's absolutely essential that we change the view in Congress, both in the House and the Senate. And of course, in November 2024, there's a presidential election. President under our system has vast powers over foreign policy. And as you point out, Biden's foreign policy vision has ended up in disaster. Remember how the United States is so much more powerful than Russia. Just by ourselves, Lou, our economy is something like 13 and a half times larger than Russia's.
Right.
The 27 economies of the European Union are 10.1 times the size of Russia's. Britain's economy, now out of the EU, is twice the size of Russia's. But despite this disparity in power, there was the greatest failure of deterrence in our lifetimes. Russia decided to invade Ukraine anyway. It was because of the failure to wield American power effectively that we are now in a crisis. And this crisis can go in many different directions, some of them the worst outcomes possible. So obviously, Biden's vision for the future just doesn't work. If I may, I can go back to one day, June 10, 2021. Biden goes to Europe for the first time. He lands at RAF Mindenhall. He addresses U.S. troops, and he has this free-flowing conversation. And during that, he says to the troops, guess what? What do you think is the world's number one national security threat? And then Biden says, my generals and admirals tell me it's climate change.
Yeah.
Well, whatever one thinks of climate change, it is not the number one national security threat. And on February 24th of this year, we learned that it certainly isn't, as Russian armor did invade Ukraine.
I would say that I would put right now, for the first time in my lifetime, certainly, I believe that we face more enemies with greater power over our future within than we do without. That is to say, China is, in my opinion, our number one enemy on the globe. But I think first we have so many threats within our own borders that it is just mystifying how people can ignore that reality, whether it be the incompetence of leadership, whether it be the shallowness of their philosophy, their thinking, their limited mental, intellectual capacity to deal with a world that is massively complex and rapidly changing. Your thoughts?
I couldn't agree with you more, Lou. We have had a failure of American leadership. We have Americans who have these incredibly misguided notions about the United States. We have teachers at all levels, secondary schools and universities, teaching hatred of America. This is a mortal threat to us. And of course, we have China and Russia and their proxies working against us. And as you pointed out earlier, they're not hesitant about killing Americans. We have 960,000 Americans who have perished from COVID-19, according to Johns Hopkins. And this was because Xi Jinping deliberately spread this disease beyond his borders. He lied about contagiousness. He pressured other countries to take arrivals from China while he was locking down his own country. Now, I know lockdowns are controversial, but by locking down his own country, he was telling the world he thought they were effective in stopping disease. So you put these two acts together, and there are more of them, but you put these two acts together, it means that every death outside of China, now there are more than 6 million of them, every death outside China is a murder, and that includes almost 1 million Americans.
And again, without anyone being held to account, without reprisal, without in any way making it right. I've never seen a time either in American history where we have done so little, have been so apathetic, so passive, and it's just deeply, deeply troubling to think that this country has permitted so many vulnerabilities to widen rather than to fix them. I've got to turn back to our discussion here on strategic vulnerabilities. And one of them is, again, Biden, Harris, I'll go on, Tony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, the entire top apparatus of our national security group under this president is so suspect, so weak, so limited. And they are talking to Venezuela. They are talking about going to Iran and begging for their oil, the Saudis as well. Why not just simply build that Keystone pipeline? I know it'll take a little time, but why not buy the Canadian oil that is available rather than going off hat in hand to Venezuelan dictators, Iranian ayatollahs? Why? What are we doing? What is the rationale, as you see it, for this administration?
It's a big mystery to me, Lou, because I don't see any rationale for the Biden administration's policies. We've seen that they fail. And you know, Lou, yes, you're right. The Keystone Pipeline will take a year to actually complete if Biden would greenlight it. But if Biden would greenlight it and he would tell the markets that, that would immediately result in a drop in the price of oil, because that's the way the markets work.
We saw it in 2005 when George W. Bush had the sense to open up offshore drilling, and the markets immediately reacted, and oil went from a top, I believe it was about $147, $150. And immediately the markets corrected and sought a much lower equilibrium, return to rational pricing. We know the same, as you say, would happen.
And the reason why this is important, among others, is that Putin's revenue is oil and gas. And the drop, and an immediate drop in hydrocarbon prices, means that he has far fewer dollars to keep his tanks running and all the rest of it. So this would, if not cripple the war effort, would severely undermine it. And if we were to do other things at the same time, we might be able to stop his advances on Ukraine. But the point is, this is within the power of the president of the United States. All he needs to do is get in back of the Resolute desk, bring the cameras into the Oval Office, say, I'm greenlighting a Keystone Pipeline, I'm opening up leases, I'm doing all the rest of this because we need to drop the price of oil, need to drop the price of gasoline. And we would see an immediate effect. Matter of fact, you know, just today, when the UAE announced that they were increasing production, the price of oil dropped $10.
Right, immediately. And
immediately.
And what do you make of the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, their leaders not even taking President Biden's telephone calls? In my lifetime, I have never known of an instance, a single instance, in which any foreign leader refused the call of an American president. And Biden was told they're not available. What do you make of that?
I can't believe the failure in American diplomacy, the failure to talk to countries and have them talk to us. But, you know, considering what Biden has been doing in the Middle East, I'm not surprised that the Saudis have brushed off Biden. Remember, President Trump, historic gains in the Middle East with the Abraham Accords. He did things that nobody thought were possible. I didn't think they were possible. And yet the Abraham Accords brought stability and peace to the region. And it also meant that the United States was far less dependent on hydrocarbons from the Middle East. And really what this means is that Saudi Arabia now has moved very much into China's orbit. And when the Saudi officials don't take a call from the president of the United States, it means that there has been a horrible diminution in America's prestige and standing in an important part of the world.
And there are only three powers, and two of them benefit if one is disadvantaged. And we are the ones being disadvantaged by the shallowest, weakest leadership that I have ever seen. I think perhaps in our entire history, we've never seen two leaders atop our government as weak, as incapable, and unfit for office as President Biden and Vice President Harris. You get the last word here on where we stand in the world and what Americans should be thinking about.
This is a critical point in history, the most critical point we've had since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 and the Checkpoint Charlie crisis a little bit earlier. Events are happening so quick that they're faster than our ability to understand them. And that means the assumptions that we make about the way the world works are often obsolete now. And because they're obsolete, we don't comprehend the danger. We need effective American leadership. And Lou, now more than ever, the American people need you.
Well, that's very kind of you, Gordon. We appreciate always your insight, your thought, your philosophy, your perspective, and your values. You're a great American, and we appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Gordon Chang, our guest tomorrow is author Rebecca Koffler. I can't wait to talk with her. Please join us here tomorrow. We want to invite you to sign up for our Great America Show Advisory and Newsletter. Simply go to loudobbs.com, that's loudobbs.com, and click on the email newsletter button. It's as simple as that. And we'll send you our advisories and alerts as well as our weekly newsletter. I don't want to overstate anything, but I'm pretty sure you will absolutely sense at least a small positive change in your world outlook. We invite you to join us and stay in touch. Thank you. That's loudobbs.com. Thanks. God bless you and God bless America.